I am serious. I finished the subject. Induced Saddam Hussein asking by when American soldiers disappeared in my eyes, when American soldiers to make this stealing.
Listening to Resonance FM, and the program is Vermilion Sounds with Peter Cusack, a program about acoustic ecology, field recording. Tonight is about Iraq, and here in the studio is Michael Cosmides, who is a journalist for the BBC World Service and who spent a number of months last year in Iraq and also in Turkey. And all that we're going to hear tonight are recordings made by Michael. Some of them are raw materials from what he recorded in Iraq, and others, like what we've just heard, are pieces constructed from that material. So, Michael.
Hello.
What have we just been listening to?
What we've been listening to is... Well, it's a stereo version of a sound, surround sound installation, and it's based around the story of... psychiatrist I met in a psychiatric hospital in Baghdad. What he's talking about is answering the question why the looting happened immediately after the Baghdad fell, as you recall, and everybody went to the streets and started looting everything. So he's giving some different explanations about it, and it's a sense of confusion, really, that to me sort of characterizes, reflects the situation of Iraq at the time, which is around June last year. It's immediately after the fall of Baghdad, the troops are in, so everybody's in a state of shock, really. That's the thing that describes it, I think, best.
Yeah. So the piece is the same doctor giving different perspectives on the looting, and so you've constructed that so you simultaneously hear the different perspectives.
Exactly, it's this sort of, he gives by chance five different perspectives of why this happened, plus he tells his own story, which you probably could make it saying, I'm alone, I'm a doctor, I'm a civilian, what can I do if people come in with knives and guns? The only thing I could say is just leave the patients alone and take everything you want, which was the case. I mean, it was really a heartbreaking situation. He was in an empty hospital, no patients, no anything really, just an empty room because everything had been looted.
Right.
And with that, there's also a loop of a theremin theme that I'm playing in the concert, which you would hear it.
Yeah. So what we thought we would do is to play some of Michael's pieces and then go back to the raw material. So should we listen to...
Sure, let's hear the explanation in he gives about looting in Iraq in a linear, if you like, mode, how he explained it to me.
Okay.
Why people suddenly start...
Yes,
very good question. There are many points... now in the newspapers we saw a leaflet saying that after Bashar al-Wahid, after Saddam Hussein forces finished, as Saddam Hussein asking the security and other groups with him to make the stealing. Why? For files of security people, for, you know, many, many top secret files This is a point. This is a military point. Maybe right, maybe wrong. We don't know. Not sure 100%. This is a point. The second point: stealing occurred really, I will say, induced. By when American soldiers, I saw by my eyes, when American soldiers entered in front of the main gate of our hospital there, the American soldiers entered the prison beside the hospital, prison of children. They make a damage or a gap in the wall of the hospital, between the prison and our hospital, in the wall of our hospital, a big gap by a target, a big gap. Why this, I ask you? This is indirectly to ask the people to enter the hospital, not from the main gate, because it is away from them, because this main gap nearer to their homes. So this is my opinion. But this is it.
That's the voice of a doctor talking in one of Baghdad's hospitals almost a year ago now, just after the end of the war. You'd like to?
Yeah, it was. You could hear him. I mean, how emotional he is, and his. Things are not clear in his mind as well, and that was the thing that I tried also to reflect when dealing with that material. He's giving this sort of different explanations. Saddam Hussein did it, say some. The Americans, as you heard, bombed the hospital, so by leaving a big hole on the wall, essentially invited everyone in. Kuwaiti soldiers came back into, went into Iraq to take revenge for the previous war. I mean, it's all sorts of things, some of which are probably... make sense and they're real, it's what happened, and some of which may well be just constructs and fantasies and whatever, but they just reflect the mood if you like, at the time.
Yeah. So this we have a.
This is more like an environment, a bit of an ambience from Children's Hospital, which was in Baghdad again. Very empty space, really, apart from the children. There's nothing much there. One of the most tragic images there in spaces would be what they called the playground, which was essentially a bare room with just a colorful poster in it.
Wow.
Nothing else there. And the most impressive, shall I say, thing was that most of the children, I mean the vast majority of them, were suffering from leukemia. And we are talking about children from really babies up to, I don't know, 10 years old or something. Leukemia, which of course might have been related, as far as we know, to the previous war, to the first Gulf War, and all the weapons that they were used at the time, depleted uranium, etc. Plus, of course, all the sanctions against Iraq that made children and everyone be in a very poor condition physically. So that's sort of an ambience of that area.
So the ambience inside Children's Hospital in Baghdad. So what's next?
Next, let's go to Baghdad in a way. It's some recording from within the car, from within the convoy, as we are traveling from Kuwait to Baghdad, arriving there. It's this big stretch of road among the desert, and it's littered with... it was littered, I should say. With cars and some tanks and other stuff around, lots of people on the streets just doing nothing really, just hanging around, running as fast as we can, because it's at the time, at least, and still I suppose it was never safe, so it's just a matter of just, you know, going as fast as you can along the road, meeting American convoys, military convoys going in and out, and that was it really, hoping for the best, you know, just drive as quickly as you can to Baghdad.
So driving very fast to Baghdad.
Driving very fast. I mean, it's a strange feeling because, of course, you arrive there and you don't know really what to expect. You have an idea. My driver is Iraqi. He speaks very, very basic English, so you could hear me trying to communicate. But the most I could do really was record sounds. It was one of the things that... I went there, of course, as a journalist, and all that material, the vast majority of it was recorded in that capacity, if you like, having in mind a journalistic, a news program where they would be used. Mm. And at the same time, I knew I wanted to use that material in some sort of another way, even if you like, as a personal catharsis, should I say, out of it. I mean, it has been a strong experience, and I had to wait really for about a year to start working with it thanks to PVA and Lab Calcio that allowed me actually to give me the opportunity to work with it.
Yeah.
So that was the convoy to Baghdad. What is, I find quite intriguing, I have this theory that, at least at the time, Iraq did not exist in the sense of a country. It's this feeling one gets when they approach the border. Usually, what do you expect to find in the border? I don't know, soldiers, I suppose, people, you know, customs, things like that. Well, there's nothing like that. You just approach from Kuwait, you finish with all the Kuwaiti side of it, and then you're just crossing over a trench, a big trench, and there you are in Iraq. There's nothing there. It's just an empty space, the trench, and all sorts of cars and trucks and etc. just hanging around, others trying to get into Kuwait, others just waiting for permits and whatever, and lots of people, again, doing nothing. I mean, at the time, as I said, it's just immediately after Iraq has fell, so it's everything in a state of shock. People just walk around not really knowing what to do. It's just everything is completely unclear, and of course we saw how this, we're seeing now, how this lack of clarity on any perspective has developed. So I find interesting the sound, this sense of no country, if you like, that you get on the Iraqi border, and I think it sounds like that.
So the border of Iraq, where it's just empty, there's hardly anything happening, sense of confusion, and nothing to hear, nothing to...
Nothing, you just heard, it's just, well, a bit of wind, thankfully, at the time, because the temperatures were already very, very high. I mean, on the way in, it was about 47 or something like that, in the shadow, under shadow, and then on the way out, it was even worse. So it's... It can be really hot, so there was a bit of wind, but really it's nothing. You just hear the cars, it's our car waiting, and it's just that it felt like a country that did not exist. There was nothing there. There was like an empty space populated by people who were really stunned, and American soldiers, of course.
Yeah, amazing. So what's next?
Let's stay a bit in Baghdad. This, what we're going to listen to is... just a bit of an ambience from a demonstration. It's outside, it's in the center of Baghdad, at the entrance of what they call the Green Zone. I mean, recently, with all the bombings, we hear it quite often. It's the headquarters of the occupying authorities, the US, etc. It's a big compound. So at the entrance there was this demonstration of former Iraqi soldiers who essentially were left without nothing. What they were saying was that to a large extent, they didn't fight, and that we know. They more or less just allowed the troops to go in, to go through, just because they wanted to get rid of Saddam Hussein themselves. But the result of that was the complete, for Bremer to dissolve the Iraqi army, and you have all these people who have really no living at all. They have no money, they have no money, no anything. And what they're trying to do is say, you know, we can help. You've got a situation, we have the know-how, we can help. Instead of that, they didn't allow them to, and the results are pretty obvious now. One interesting thing here. This gate, the main gate of the compound and the main bridge that connects it, which of course is a former Saddam Hussein palace, it's called Jumhuriya Bridge and Jumhuriya Gate, which means the Republic Bridge, if you like, and the Republic Gate. What I found interesting was this sort of... imposition of different names. When I went to ask at some point the Americans where it was, because I wanted to go, as we hear later, embedded, as we say, patrolling with them, they tried to explain, well, to my translator, who was Iraqi from Baghdad, that we had to go to the Assassin's Gate and the Assassin's Bridge, which, of course, does not exist in Arabic, does not exist in Iraq, does not exist into anything. It's just the code name they had given themselves, and they were trying to impose, in a way, perhaps unwillingly, but trying to impose it on Iraqis themselves. And I think it's a very interesting story in how you deal with people. You have there someone from Baghdad, and you're trying to tell them, go to Assassin's Bridge or Assassin's Gate, when it has such a beautiful name, I think, Jamhuriya Bridge and Jamhuriya Gate. It's the gate of the Republic, and it has nothing to do with Saddam Hussein, has nothing to do with anything.
Anyway,
that was a... Let's listen to a bit of the demonstration. It was a pretty tense situation, because already there was... the situation was tense. Some American troops were coming in. Apparently one of them got confused, scared or whatever, and started shooting, so there were two people dead. So what you hear is a bit like the reflects the tension at the time, I think.
نفس الحكي نسوي نقاب كل جماعه
واحد التاكسي صعدنا مجموعه
عندنا ترى اربعه
اكو عدد زياده ليش سويتوا لهم شيء
كل شيء ما سوينا
هم قالوا لنا 18 كاف
على مود الحقوق اللي تسوون بينا انذار يهود انذار
Okay, so that was the demonstration, and from then you became embedded for a night.
Yes.
What does that really mean?
Oh my goodness.
What does it sound like?
I'll tell you what it sounds like. I mean, let's play a bit. I did another piece, which again is a sort of a surround piece, trying to reflect the situation I lived, being with the American troops overnight, with imposing the curfew, you know, going around the streets of Baghdad, establishing checkpoints, stopping people to check them and all that. So let's listen, if you want, to this piece I prepared, which is based on that, and then we'll try to go through it and then see how it's developed. So.
Scouts.
feel myself to do something good when I work with these guys to make a security in Baghdad. I got a flak jacket and damn boots, so it's too heavy and it's too hot. Somebody tries to kill me because I'm an interpreter with US forces. They tried to kill me twice before. First time before about 2 weeks, and the second time before 5 or 6 days exactly.
لهم معارض السيارات تبتيس صار لهم 5 ساعات من ساعة ما يهدى أسأل هدهم معارض ما سيارتهم أسأل هدهم
Me 18 How old are you?
12
You guys are short for being 18
So that was it. That's hopefully reflects somehow the experience of being patrolling around with the American troops in Baghdad. It's a piece that is based mainly around footsteps and my sound, my breathing, really, as we are walking. And you can hear how heavy it is. It feels very, very bad, and it's very hard, actually, to work and do anything walking in under very hot conditions with the flak jacket and everything. So you can imagine, I mean, every step it's a real struggle.
You make it sound incredibly oppressive.
I think it is.
Yeah.
I think, I mean, it's I'm glad you say it, because it's, that's the feeling you get. And I mean, if you like, on the journalistic level, one of the things that I've surprised myself, I mean, I was thinking about it, I didn't expect it, is how much you tend to identify with the people you are with. You are there with the American soldiers and you are working with them, you know, chatting with them and going around. And of course, I'm against the war. I mean, it's not a matter of a logical feeling. But there you are exposed with them. And you're part of the same group, if you like.
Yeah.
You feel protected by them in many ways. You are as much of a target as they are. I don't know if my blue flak jacket with the big press on it would make any difference if anyone wanted to attack us at that time. And of course, to an Iraqi, you are in the same group again. Okay, you may say press and you are, okay, this bloody bastard really that just came along and is following those guys around. So it's easy to see. I mean, from that experience, it's very easy to understand why sometimes you see the army and then all the people around be so happy to have journalists embedded. You get to develop some sort of connection to them, which is very tricky. You don't expect it. this piece, so it's based about that. It's using incidents, if you like, incident sounds from people we met and the Humvee itself as we were in and all that.
Should we hear a bit of the raw recordings?
Of the Humvee, yeah. Let's
inside
hear.
Inside the Humvee, yeah.
That's inside the Humvee, so that's how it sounds as you're going to patrol Baghdad.
Short recordings from inside an American Army Humvee in Baghdad on patrol, and they really do play rock music all the time.
Oh, they're doing rock music and country music and anything you can imagine. To be fair to them, it's a very tense situation. It's not an easy thing to go out and know that you're a target. I mean, I suppose you need something like that to feel a bit more relaxed, but you cannot help not thinking being in a movie to be. I mean,
yeah, I mean, it's like the old Apocalypse Now scenario, isn't it?
Exactly. Yeah, and it feels very strange in being in that. It's a very loud car, as you hear. I mean, the noise of the engine is very loud. You've got this level of you know, the loud music going on, and then the secondary level of the sound, which probably you were able to hear it, which is the radio, as they are you know, getting instructions and then working how it is.
Yeah.
It's a very intriguing place, and you know, in terms of from a sound perspective, if you like.
Yeah, I mean, it's just so many different levels of culture squashed together in one car.
Exactly. Another interesting thing I found, which is worth perhaps listening a bit, is the sound of the generators, the noise of the generators. We are walking on the streets we are on foot patrol now. It's night. Now, remember that even now, but especially then, Baghdad has, in all effects, no electricity. There is some electricity for some time, but really for most of the time, people have to rely on generators. So it's, you get the sense of the night that is part of the soundscape of the night, the humming of the electricity generators, which you will hear in a moment, and that I find intriguing.
Okay.
αυτοί οι βόμβοι δυνατοί που ακούγονται κάθε τόσο προέρχονται από τις γεννήτριες που έχουν πολλά σπίτια για να έχουν ηλεκτρικό, γιατί οι διακοπές είναι πολύ τακτικές στο ρεύμα.
So the soundscape, or the night soundscape of Baghdad about a year ago, one of the main sounds is just constant humming of many generators, the only way that many people could get a regular electricity supply.
Exactly, it's something that really describes, characterizes the sound of the night, if you like, in Baghdad.
Yeah, it's amazing, because my imagined imagining of the soundscape of Baghdad, there would be a lot of gunfire all the time, and maybe distant booms and bangs and things, and for you it was actually just generator humming.
Generator humming, and there is, you have this, it's not constant, I mean the constant sort of fighting, you had it during the actual war. Then you have things that, depends how you see it, anyway, if you're close to it, you may listen to it. Actually, there was some gunfighting while I was patrolling. But one intriguing thing was that it was recorded. It was not like I missed, I happened to have the microphone on at the time. But still, it doesn't sound anything as close or as loud even as it felt when I was there. Yeah. It was a very intriguing thing. When I came back to that material, it was one of the things that I was, in a way, looking forward, so to speak, in terms of sound, to find this sort of best sort of... weapons, which was about, I don't know, 400 or 500 meters from away from us. It was quite close. And still, the way it was recorded really surprised me. It was not, I don't know, I cannot exactly remember how it happened and, you know, where I had the microphone at the time or anything, but it was very intriguing to see, you know, the perception of the sounds and the memory of them, and then seeing them against what has actually been recorded and how it has been recorded. That was an intriguing thing in this process of going through that material. And just before we leave Baghdad, I mean, I think it's just a nice touch to listen to a bit of, like, the ghetto blaster, if you like, but sort of Baghdad style, on a lighter note.
See, you kids step near the truck, start talking to us, all of a sudden we draw a crowd.
How strict are you with the curfew?
What's up?
How strict are you with the curfew? I mean,
any truck we...
It's any time now, so I mean...
Yeah, it's here in a few minutes. Usually we're kind to them, we give them about 10 minutes after, let them get home. But any car after that, we'll usually pull one truck on every side of the road and just drive down. Any car will stop. We'll stop and we'll search them, search the truck. You know, and if we find any weapons, you know, we'll take them, detain them, bring them into the pen.
If not, I mean, if it's just someone who, for whatever reason, was out late,
then we let them go. But we can't, you know, they'll probably might get picked up again for another one and another one until they get home. And some guys aren't as lenient as us. We don't take them in just for breaking curfew, but some people do. Some units do. Like, since we only got our sector, we don't cross into other people's. If they drive in another person's sector, they can detain them. Light. No, not a light. Knife. But,
no light.
No light? Light.
Give me.
No. What you gonna get? What do you give me?
No.
You give me.
Hey.
You hear me?
Watch. Watch.
I got a watch. You gotta give me something I don't have. Mine has.
Another Baghdad on patrol night scene from about a year ago. What was actually going on there?
It was a bit surreal. I mean, you were with these American troops. We have stopped at some point. It was a guy who had this big tape recorder, really, you know, tape player, on the back of his bicycle with the music we were listening to. I mean, very happy about it and going around with the music and the children around and me, as you heard, trying to interview and then discuss the situation with the American soldiers. It was a bit of a surreal moment in the middle of all that.
Yeah, amazing. So, Baghdad, but you also went to other places.
Yeah, Najaf and Kufa, which is the two holy sites, if you like, of the Shia Muslims. Kufa is, they're very close to each other. It's very difficult. You cannot even realize when you cross from one town to the other. Kufa being the place, the mosque where Ali, the founder of Shia Islam, was preaching and where he was murdered, and Najaf, which is the place where he's actually buried. So it's very holy sites.
Yeah, and both are very much in the news now.
And they are very much so. I was there on the Friday, of course, for the Friday prayers, and I started with Najaf, where this guy called Bakir al-Hakim was preaching at the time. You might recall him. He came from Iran. He was Iraqi, but he was in Iran, and then he came back. He was part of an organization called Skiri, and he was killed in a bomb explosion in Najaf sometime last year. So here is a bit of him preaching, and you can also hear me asking my translator what's going on and what he's saying, because, of course, I don't speak Arabic.
يتفضل إنسان للنهي عنها أو في موارد المعروف
What I want to tell you is that if the man has the ability to make a distinction between evil and good, this will protect him from doing bad things. The evil is that to close the mosques. This is one of the
تسهيل مرور الناس وكذلك مرور العربات.
أما أن يأتي الإنسان related to our daily life is that to allow to people to pass in order if someone stopped in the streets and don't allow to others to pass. This is an also evil act.
هذه ليست ملكا شخصيا لهذا الإنسان حتى يجوز له أن يشغل عليه
المعابر. Muslims must be the good one.
أمام السالكين أو العابرين أو العربات التي تسلك وهكذا من العناوين التي نراها ومسألة التصرف بل سرقة الأموال العامة الأموال التي هي أموال للمسلمين أموال لعامة المسلمين سواء كانت في المؤسسات العامة التي تقدم خدمات لهؤلاء المسلمين
And we have to be cooperative with those people and establishments of which give to the people services, for example, the hospitals. We have to say that to people.
So that was Bakir al-Hakim preaching in Najaf, where he was killed, about a month or a couple of months after this recording was made. And after Najaf, I moved to Kufa, which is the next thing, and where Muqtada al-Sadr, the Ayatollah who is now in the middle of all it, was preaching. And I must say, it's a very strong experience, it's a very strong feeling one gets there with thousands of people, you know, in this mixture of religion and politics, which is very difficult to differentiate. You probably heard it already in what Bakir al-Hakim was saying in his preaching. So here we have a bit of it's the imam, I suppose he's called, singing or chanting the Allahu Akbar with big gaps in between. So people, it's thousands of people praying, worshipping God, worshipping Allah, and then again the invocation, Allahu Akbar, and then the big pause in the worshipping and over again, which I think is just...
So this is his chanting is coming over loudspeakers into a big space where there are thousands of people. Is
it? It's a very big mosque, and people are worshiping it in the mosque, but also outside in all the areas surrounding. I mean, you can consider those two cities more or less. I mean, they're very religious cities. The center of them is those two mosques, the one where Ali preached and died, and the other where Ali is buried. So obviously that's the very focal point of life there.
No! بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. اللهم صل على محمد وآل محمد. اللهم فكما أمرت بالتوبة وضمنت القبول وحفظت على الدعاء.
The silence is stunning in that, isn't it?
Yeah, it's quite amazing. It's very powerful. You're a journalist. You make these recordings as part of your job. But do these recordings ever get played on the programmes you make? You're a radio journalist, I should add.
Yeah.
Do you ever play these recordings on...
Sometimes, yes. Mm. I mean, it depends. Of course, obviously, if it's an interview or something like that, yes, you're more likely to listen to it. The sounds you are hearing here, like more ambient sounds, you may get a glimpse of them in perhaps in a package, just like a few seconds or something.
Yeah.
But no, you really don't have this opportunity of the airtime, if you like we have here, the airspace, and the opportunity to listen to them and you know, try and get a different perspective and a different feeling of a situation, a country, whatever it is.
Because, I mean, it just strikes me that the sort of minute and a half we've heard of that gives such a powerful impression that, but of a different sort from somebody talking about the experience is what we normally get on standard reportage from everywhere, really.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it seems crazy to me that not more use is made of just the raw material and the sounds that are around in everyday reportage. It just doesn't seem to happen.
I do agree. I mean, lots of my colleagues, and I'm sure, and I've heard some, and I'm sure of others, there's a whole lot of material there that is really intriguing in exactly the sense that you're talking about, in the sense of giving a different perspective without the need to add any other commentary on that. But unfortunately, it's not available. Sometimes I think that journalists feel a bit uncomfortable with it. Yeah. It's the unedited material. It's the material that I don't have control about. Right. Otherwise, I'm talking to you, I'm interviewing you. Fine, I edit it, I play it, I do whatever. I'm taking bits and pieces of sound from an area, and I'm using it. And then I'm still in control, I'm the journalist. But then, this is the raw material, as I have my microphone and my tape on and just running around and everything, and then it's me saying things that I would not like to say, and I'm surprised to hear myself saying, or things happening that I forgot or I would rather forget, or it's a very uncomfortable thing. And part of my dealing with this material was exactly, you know, try to get into some sort of relation, if you like, with that perspective as well. I think it's, as you say, it's a valid material, and in some ways it's more telling about a certain situation than anything I can say, me or any other journalist for that matter, in any report about Iraq.
Yeah. You also went to the Turkish border region.
Yeah, it was for quite a long time. I mean, actually most of the war I spent it there in the Turkish-Iraqi border, which is the Kurdish area, of course. Before arriving at the actual border, which was in this small town called Silopi, I went through Diyarbakir, which is the Kurdish capital, if you like, in Turkey. So it so happened that it was the festival of Nowruz, which is like the New Year, we could say, the coming of Easter or something like that. Very tense situation, essentially a gathering of, I think, probably up to 100,000 people, but certainly tens of thousands of people celebrating it, Kurds under watchful Turkish army all around it. And, as you will hear in the thing we are going to listen to now, with the airplanes passing over them quite low. I don't know if it was on purpose or not, but it was. You can hear that it's a bit intimidating.
We want just peace. We don't want war.
We don't want war.
Just we want peace. They said this war not apart from opposite to Saddam. Just is want destroy the Kurdish people.
So I'm sure you realized which was the sound of the airplane passing close by at the time. Just to play a little of this person, I think, if I remember correctly, that he is the mayor of Diyarbakir, speaking to the gathering of the people. And I find fascinating the way his intonation, the way he speaks, actually. I don't know what he's saying exactly, but it sounds great.
Yıllardır yürüttüğümüz mücadelede her gün imlek imlek, oya oya bugünlere gelmemizi sağlayan değerli kadın kardeşlerim. Yürekleri nevroz ateşiyle yanan genç kardeşlerim, sevgili Diyarbakır halkı, hepinize saygılarımızı, sevgilerimizi iletiyoruz. Merhaba. Çok değerli arkadaşlarım, bu Nevroz bugüne kadar kutladığımız Nevrozlardan farklı bir zamanda, farklı şartlarda kutlanıyor. İşte yanı başımızda bir zamandan bu yana, ha bugün ha yarın çıktı çıkacak derken başlayan bir savaşın sonucunda burada toplanmışız. Nevroz'un ruhuna, özüne yaraşır bir şekilde, savaşlara inat bir şekilde barışı, kardeşliği ve özgürlüğü aykırıyoruz.
The mayor of Diyarbakir in Turkey, that's the capital of the Kurdish part of Turkey, speaking to is it annual Kurdish music?
It's an annual festival. It's like festival. The welcoming of spring, if you like. You could say it's like the equivalent of New Year in a way, the Kurdish New Year.
Right.
It's celebrated also here in Britain, I mean, in all the Kurdish community.
Sure, yeah.
Have a big celebration on it. But there in Diyarbakir, it's pretty tricky.
Yeah, I mean, at that time, the Turkish army could have gone into Iraq themselves, couldn't it?
It was. That was the reason I was in Turkey and we were in Turkey. So waiting essentially to follow the Turkish army into Iraq or find a way to smuggle ourselves into Iraq. I mean, that was the basic point. So after a long time, after about a month there, I mean, from about 600 journalists in a place, most of them have left. We are left just a couple of friends, two Italian journalists and one Israeli and myself, doing nothing, being tired and just waiting for our orders to go back in a way. And we go to these mountains, which is the mountains where the PKK is supposed to have gone.
The PKK are the Turkish guerrillas that have been fighting the Turkish army for decades.
For decades. So it's a bit of a surreal situation because you've got this Judy, it's called, it's this mountain, and everything is facing that. You've got army posts facing it, you've got loudspeakers facing the mountain for no apparent reason, and lights facing the mountain again for no reason because there's no chance that they reach it or anything. But you have this feeling that, you know, it's the center of attention is that. So we tried to go there, and of course we were cut off in our road by the soldiers and all that. And in the middle of all that, we just stopped nearby a stream, and that was one of the most peaceful moments, and I think it was just journalists trying to relax after probably a bit of a hard time.
So you've been listening to Vermilion Sounds, the Acoustic Ecology and Field Recording Programme with Peter Cusack. And I'd like to thank Michael Kosmides coming in to play all his recordings from Iraq.
Thank you.
And I shall hand you over to Kath Matthews.